I'm Douglas Brush, and you're listening to Cybersecurity Interviews. Cybersecurity Interviews is the weekly podcast dedicated to digging into the minds of the influencers, thought leaders, and individuals who shape the cybersecurity industry. I discover what motivates them, explore their journey in cybersecurity, and discuss where they think the industry is going. The show lets listeners learn from the expert stories and hear their opinions on what works and doesn't in cybersecurity. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Cybersecurity Interviews. In this episode, we're speaking with Ismael Valenzuela. He's defined by his peers as a passionate, experienced, and visionary individual who's always striving to improve himself. Ismael is one of the few individuals that has done almost all in the InfoSec arena, from founding one of the first IT security companies in Spain to managing a distributed cert across the world, as well as teaching for SANS, BSI, or the Spanish National Center of Intelligence. His command of both the business and technical aspects of information security has allowed him to specialize in building and boosting highly technical security teams and successful security businesses across North America, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, India, and Australia for the past 15 years. Ismael has provided security consultancy, advice, and guidance to large government and private organizations, including major EU institutions and U.S. government agencies. Prior to joining Foundstone Services at Intel Security, Ismael worked as a global IT security manager for iSoft Group, which is one of the world's largest providers of healthcare IT solutions. He's the author of security articles for Hacking, Insecure Magazine, and the SANS Forensic Blog. Ismael also serves on the GIEC Advisory Board and is a community SANS instructor, and also holds numerous certifications, including the highly regarded GIEC Security Expert. In this interview, we will discuss how he learned security on his own, scoping penetration testing projects, security in the healthcare industry, running international cert teams, how to drive an internal security culture, developing internal training programs, threat hunting and his Rastrador tool, lessons learned from his IR work, and so much more. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks for listening. All right. Ismael, thank you for joining me on Cybersecurity Interviews. How are you today?
Good, very good. Well, thank you, Zach.
I kind of wanted to get started. I read on several of your different blog pieces and different things that you've had posted online, some of the things that you developed as far as some of the software. But one thing caught my eye that was on your blog that said, you know, and I quote, a passionate InfoSec professional at day and an IT security geek at night. So you have a passion for cybersecurity. And why is that? And what keeps you so passionate about cybersecurity after, you know, 15 or so plus years of doing it?
Right. Well, that's a good question. First of all, I'm sorry if you had to read my blog. I haven't updated it for a while, and mainly because there are so many things to do right these days. But there's always like things to have on the back burner, you know, ready to blog. And the truth is that I've been blogging a lot of stuff on other blogs other than mine recently, including the Internet Storm Center for SANS and many others. But we'll get there. What keeps me passionate? This is what I've been doing, as you said, for the last 16 years, and it's a challenge, right? I think as most of us, right, geeks, we are driven by challenges, and there's a constant challenge in this industry, and no matter how much you know, you always feel you know nothing, right? And there's so many ways in which, you know, you can try to solve problems and help people in various ways with something as important as protecting their information, their privacy, crown jewels for the organizations we work with. That's I think what keeps me passionate about it, the challenge of learning and helping others too.
Yeah, definitely. I feel many people in the industry, myself included, have the same kind of approach to it, that every day there's something new. You can never really get too bored in doing security.
Exactly.
And kind of looking back at your history, I saw in 2001 you co-founded G2 Security as kind of a startup, a company from scratch where you had to really kind of manage all aspects of that. So tell us a little bit about that experience and why you decided to start your own thing as opposed to just going out of the gate and working for somebody else.
Okay, that's a long story. What do you have to do in the next hour?
Fair enough.
Okay, so I was in college, and you know, I think something that is kind of a common thing along my career is that I had never planned anything. Right, it wasn't like, hey, I'm going to start my own company, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. I just went with you know, the opportunities and took them and did what I thought was the best thing at the time. So I was in college and I was doing computer science, and it was my third year. And I remember walking into the campus and seeing this advertisement saying, "If you understand this, we will hire you." And I was walking along with a friend of mine, and at that point, you know, I was connected to the internet. I was trying to learn stuff on my own, because what I learned at the university was kind of boring for the most part, right? Except for the labs and some of the programming stuff that I really enjoyed. And I already did a bunch of programming during high school. So by the time I got to the university, that was the thing that really attracted me the most. But I started to read manuals on my own on, you know, how to set up servers, like Apache servers, do some kind of database programming for the web. So I started to look a little bit at PHP and, you know, SQL statements. So this was 1998, I believe. And it said, if you understand this, we'll hire you. And also bear in mind, this is southern Spain. This is Malaga. It's more like a touristic place. So there's not a huge industry, a huge IT industry, not back then. Now it's a bit more, let's say, not extensive, but it's still a small city, but it's more common, right? And it was a bunch of PHP code and SQL code. So I read that. It's like, yeah, I understand what's going on here. This is a SQL statement, and it's just selecting these fields and doing this and blah, blah, blah. So my friend goes and says, hey, why don't you apply for this? And I was like, well, you know, I'm still studying. And so I didn't really think much about it. But in the afternoon, I felt like, well, why not? Just, you know, let's see what happens. It's something you like. And I don't even know if you can, if they can adapt to my schedule or if it's going to work, but let's try. So I sent them an email, and they actually contacted me back the same afternoon saying, hey, we want to interview you. So I went to this interview, and it was, you know, the .com kind of bubble time. And I started just working part-time doing a portal that at the time we called topfootball.com. And it was, again, this is 98, right, beginning of 99. And we're doing this portal that is kind of a social kind of a media platform, something like a little Facebook, something like this, but oriented to the people that played soccer, like young guys, and to so they could create their own clubs and their own teams and stuff like that. And they would be put in contact with agents that would represent them. And it was an interesting idea. And I started to code in PHP, in ColdFusion at the time as well. And since I was the only one that I knew a little bit about system administration and setting up these servers, I ended up just managing the servers where we hosted all of these applications. I remember having to secure some of these things and, you know, setting up a SQL server, trying to secure it, trying to secure also Windows and NT boxes and all that fun stuff. And eventually, I think it was sometime after we put the application into production, my main job was just to keep everything running and to do that system administration and secure all of that. A friend of mine told me that there was a problem, security problem, in the website of the town hall. And I started to look at that, and don't know why, I did a port scan, and I figured out a poor 1433 TCP was open to the world. And it was like, wow, I know this is SQL server, right? And about that time, I don't know if you remember that, but most of the SQL servers, they shipped with this user, right? SA.
Right,
SA. With blank, like password. You see where this leads to, right?
Good old Apache.
And,
I said good old Apache, yeah.
So SQL Server, right, running on 1433 TCP, user FA, blank password. And I'm just poking around and having a look. And I'm speaking to someone else and on my keyboard. And it's like, this is not going to work, right? But I get the authentication screen, the pop-up, and I just type FA, no password, bum, I have access to everything, right? And this server was hosted by a company that hosted lots of databases for major town halls across the whole country. So it wasn't just this particular one. And there were some, you know, political issues at the time. It was like very sensitive data. And immediately I just freaked out. It's like, wow, what's this? This shouldn't be exposed to the world, right? If I'm seeing these, who else can see it? So it triggered kind of an interesting conversation. I obviously talked to my friends, like, hey, do you know who we can contact in this place so I can tell them to secure this and you know, filter this port on the firewall, blah, blah, blah. And they actually call back and they get in touch with me. They didn't know how to do this. And my manager at the time, my boss at the time, he was working for this. This company was set up by his father, that was an entrepreneur. And this guy had businesses that had nothing to do with IT. It was mostly like representing soccer players and music industry and, you know, putting together concerts to bring Rolling Stones or Sting. It was an interesting environment. And he had a very good connection with the media. So he said, hey, Ishmael, this is pretty cool. I'm going to call the journalist and, you know, maybe we can use this to give us some publicity. And I was like, wow, no. I don't want to have anything to do with this. And, you know, this is sensitive data. And I was like, well, don't worry. We will not mention your name. We'll just mention the name of the company and all of that. So the journalist came and I sat with him. I told him, you know, everything that I observed. And also I showed him that I got rid of all the data that I saw and that we called these people. We told them how to fix everything. And the next day, very next day, I think this was a Saturday, and it was on the front page of the local newspaper, data from the town hall exposed without protection on the internet, right? And this went back and forth for a few days. The town hall, I think, sued the company, something like that. So I was so glad to be on that, quoted or my name on that article at all. And eventually, you know, it all settled down. And of course, you can imagine the system administrator, once the manager, right, asked him, hey, what happened here? He probably said, he didn't say, hey, I have this exposed to the internet without filtering and with the default password. He said, hackers broke into our server. So that was actually on the front page of the newspaper the day after hackers got into this database, blah, blah, blah. But eventually everything was fixed and everything was clarified. And long story short, the owner of that company, right, the father of my boss, was the same age as I was pretty young. He came to me and said, hey, I built this company with my son to do this kind of portals and applications, but I see that you really have some kind of talent and knowledge about this security thing. And I don't know of any other company offering this kind of services. Would you like to set up a company with me? Essentially he just paid for everything. He paid my salary and we did like a 50-50 deal. And I built my own company with this entrepreneur like that. And I started to work on my own. So this was end of 2000. And I think it was probably the second IT security company that was founded in Spain at the time. And taking into consideration that I wasn't in a big city like Madrid or Barcelona, where, you know, you have easy access to big corporations that would have a demand on these services, it was quite challenging, but it was an awesome learning experience. So I was like very young and I had to build everything from scratch. I was on my own, so I did everything. I remember going to London to InfoSec World in 2001 and just going around trying to see what other big consultancies were offering and trying to learn from, you know, what kind of marketing material they would use, how they would offer their portfolio, and learning from all of that and doing everything from the website myself to the brochures, to visiting customers, to deploying, implementing. That went on for some time until we sold the company to a bigger one.
How did you manage to balance your time with all that of being able to try to grow a company and still keep your skills sharp as you were, you know, starting this new venture?
Well, I had to do everything, right, on my own. So if we would, you know, sell a VPN project or a penetration testing project or anything like that, I would have to do this, right? And I would have to deliver it. I remember my first project was a big penetration test against one of the major agencies in the country. And this was really funny because, you know, I was 34, I was very young, I didn't know much about business. And one of the first things that I did was to go to Madrid and to go to the big consultancies, you know, the Big Four and many others, and try to sell my services to them so they could subcontract me and do this work for them. And I remember on one of these, I mean, I would never say that I was just on my own, right? But I had like really good marketing material, and I always spoke as, hey, we do this, we do that. So it kind of made an impression that we were like maybe obviously a small team, but that it wasn't just me on my own. I never lied, of course, but I always, you know, tried to make a good impression, right, on our capabilities. And in this particular case, I remember I got a call back, and this was by the end of, I think, 2001, a few days before the holidays in December. And I got a call saying, hey, we have a big customer. They want to have a, they didn't say big customer. We have a customer. We want to do a penetration test. And they asked me for a quote. So I thought, well, you know, $6,000 seems like was euros at the time, right? It was sounded like a lot of money. And the guy on the phone said, like, deal. I was like, I should have asked for more money, right? That was probably too low. And I forgot, again, lack of experience. I forgot to ask a key question and scope the project properly, right? And I asked who's the customer and you know, what are the details of the delivery for this project. And it was a big agency for the government. And I was like, wow. This is going to be hard, right? So this is my first professional project. I have to do a penetration test against one of the largest infrastructures in the country. And this is going to be probably my first project and my last one. And I remember going to Madrid the very next day to sit down with this, with the officer, security officer for this agency, together with the sales guy from this big consultancy that was subcontracting me, and saying, hey, we're receiving attacks from the Chinese government. And we need you to find this out. And you can imagine, again, very young, lack of experience. And it was like, wow, you know, I definitely know about penetration testing, but this is like my first real professional project, right? And I was thinking this is like way out of proportion. And they said, well, you got to find out what's going on. We need the report in like 3 days, something like that. Of course, the sales guy said, we're going to provide you with this, of course. Ismail will do this. So I remember like going back home and just, you know, spending like 3 days without any sleep, just scanning over the IPs, the DMZ that they had and trying to find something. And I found just a few, you know, minor things, maybe information on low vulnerabilities, but nothing like really outstanding. And I was like, wow, this is going to be really, really bad. And I remember scanning that like, I don't know, dozens of times, trying to find every single possible way to get in. And the very last day before we had to deliver the report, I remember like scanning once again. It was late in the evening. And then I found an IP address that wasn't there. And I was like, wow, I haven't seen this one before. What is this? And it seems to be like a machine that maybe they used for a lab or some other purposes. But it was an IIS, right, Internet Information Server. And they had this vulnerability that at the time was being exploited by, do you remember Code Red?
Oh, yeah.
So that was the time, right? And this worm, which has an interesting story, but this worm left a page on these compromised servers that said hacked by Chinese. So it wasn't that the Chinese government was actively, you know, exploiting that that infrastructure specifically. It was more like a worm that was going around leaving this message behind. But using this vulnerability, I was able to go from the DMC to the database. And obviously, this web server was in the DMC, but guess where the database server was located?
Right next to it.
Well, it was in the LAN, right?
Oh, okay.
So I was able to execute commands with XPCMD shell, right? So just right through that connection, executing system-level commands on the SQL server. It was on the LAN, so I could just move laterally.
And then you were in, yeah.
Pivot, and I was seeing it was like, you know, bird dancing and and all of that. And that was my very first project. So as you can see, you know, I had to do everything, including delivery and figuring out things as I went through it. So it was a great experience. And eventually I ended up selling the company and moving into a position that was like an internal position doing security engineering for a large organization that did software for healthcare, a British organization. And again, with each different job that I've had, I've been trying to do something different, something, again, challenging that would allow me to learn more. And I've always kind of tried to balance some kind of, you know, business skills. I love talking to people. I love teaching. I love translating technical, highly technical stuff into something that is actionable. So someone that is managing an organization, right, or driving a project can do something with it and drive improvement, right?
Yeah, one of the things I noticed too is, okay, so you moved to, I believe it was iSoft around 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. You're there for a number of years. So now you were once the solo guy, and now you move to a much larger organization that has a global footprint, and you're working with a global security program. So how are you dealing with kind of the daily global security for an organization like that when you were just one person? What changes were you making as far as your own management style of dealing with global teams?
Right. Yeah, it was a complete change of everything, really, right? Pace and culture. And this company was in a huge project called the National Program for IT, which at the time was a project in the UK that was pushed by Tony Blair at the time. And they wanted to create a single repository of data, like a centralized database with all the health records for all the patients, all the citizens in the UK, right? So a huge project. And iSoft, this company I was working for, was tasked with providing the middleware software that would be implemented across all these different hospitals across the country. So they had like 3,000 developers in India, operations in all across Europe, Australia, and yeah, that was pretty much it. And when I started working there, I was pretty much like the only one working there that knew how to implement security countermeasures, right? So obviously there was a big network team, a big system administration team, but they weren't focused on security. So they built this security team, but it was mostly for compliance purposes in the beginning, right? To be compliant with ISO 27001, because it was a requirement for the project, right? As a contractor in this project, you had to be certified in ISO 27001. So that was the beginning, my kind of first project there, working with various teams to try to get sites certified on specific processes on ISO 27001. And it was a great learning experience because it again, it allowed me to learn a lot about not just technical stuff, but what works and what doesn't, right? And how to make things work in different culture environments, etc. So first of all, when I walk into a new environment, I try to learn, just try to listen as much as I can, because I don't know what works and what doesn't. And the people that's been working there for quite some time, they know better than I do. And then eventually I try to drive these changes, taking into consideration all these cultural differences and backgrounds, etc. And something that was very effective at the time, when I obviously understood that there was a need for people being trained in security, understanding the risks and how to apply mitigation strategies, was to do internal training, especially because I would be working with people that I never met, like face to face, and I would have to, you know, ask folks in the Netherlands, for instance, to do some stuff, ask folks in the UK to do certain things, folks in Germany to do some others. And especially when you don't have a personal relationship with anyone, when you haven't seen them face to face, you don't understand their problems, what they have to cope with on a daily basis, it's kind of cold and it's difficult, right? Just, hey, this guy is calling me saying that I have to do these, right, or apply these settings to this GPO, or that I have to apply these changes on the firewall, that I have to deploy this machine that is going to sniff traffic over this segment. Why should I do this? So I started to develop an internal training program, a two-day training program, and I went through all of these sites around Europe and even Australia, India, and I had the opportunity to meet people face to face and then teach them this is the real threat, right? And this is how attackers get in and how easy it is for them to do this. And I remember teaching like secure coding practices to developers that I've been developing for like 20 years. And yes, they knew what SQL injection was. They knew what cross-site scripting was, but they never saw it. They never felt it, right? So they never saw how important was this and how, what the impact, right? They never understood the real impact of these things. When I would demonstrate this to them, it's like, look, this is how easy it is to exploit it, and this is the impact, and this is how you fix it, right? It's not that difficult. But they have to do this, and they did this on their own. I prepared labs, so it was like a very hands-on driven kind of training. And it worked. It worked great. I ended up managing the security team for this organization. It was bought by Australian. It was acquired by an Australian company after that, and I ended up reporting to the CIO in Sydney, in Australia, and being part of the senior leadership over there. And it was great because it allowed me to build pretty much everything from scratch instead of doing it for other organizations as a consultant, right? I had the opportunity to do this in this multinational environment internally in this case.
All right. And one of the things I just want to touch on is when you're talking to internal people and maybe pointing out to things that they could possibly kind of maybe take offense to, where you're saying, hey, look, you're doing something that might put the organization at risk. How well was that received, or how did you navigate those types of issues so somebody wouldn't become defensive and be open enough to talking to you about solving the problems?
So, yeah, exactly. That's what happens in most organizations, right? When the concept of someone auditing you is someone pointing at, you know, what you're doing wrong. And that's something that no one likes, really. So the approach, since I observed that wasn't working at all, and especially with all these different cultural differences, right? If you work in Europe, you know this, that each country is completely different way of doing things. And for instance, if a British would tell a German to do something, they would say, no, well, why would we do this, right? Or the same thing the Dutch. And there's all these little things that you have to navigate, right?
It's only been going on, course, what, a couple hundred years of distrust. So, yeah, it's a little bit different.
Right. Exactly. And then all the politics, of course, that it's in everywhere. So what I found that was the most effective way was saying, hey, I'm going to give you, I'm going to go to your site. I'm going to do a 2-day training class on, for instance, if it was like the development shops in India, I did like secure coding, right? I'm going to do a workshop, a 2-day workshop on secure coding. Who wants to attend? And, you know, it's free training. Everyone would sign up for that. So instead of just going and telling them, hey, this is what you're doing wrong, I would teach them, hey, this is what's going on out there, right? These are the latest threats. This is how hackers break into the organizations. And this is what we, how we can mitigate these risks, right? And then eventually by the second day, you've developed a relationship with them. You went out maybe dinner with them. And now you can start asking questions. And they will actually ask you, right? So you don't even have to point it out. They will actually say, hey, can you please help us with this? Because I think we might have a problem here. Now that they understand and they see what the problem is, right? Or I developed a 2-day training class in forensics and incident response. So I taught these guys, I gave them an image of a compromise system, and it was like a game, right? Let's try to find out what happened with this system and how it was compromised. And then along the lines, we had lots of opportunities to discuss, like, you know, what are the things that we could be doing better? And this always worked like really, really well. Instead of just, hey, I run, I don't know, a scan, or I send you a report, or we do a conference call and I tell you on a call that you have to fix this because this is not working. That strategy was the one that I worked the best for me over the years.
Very good. And just want to touch a little bit on too. So you're working with healthcare within the healthcare industry or the mid to around the last 10 years or so. But one of the things I noticed too in the more recent data breach reports that have come out now and, you know, 10 years later from when you were in the industry is that healthcare has now become this noticeable target in a lot of the data breach reports. Was healthcare always a target and we're more aware of it now? Or is it something that's new that attackers are going after as opposed to financial services and other industries?
Well, I think that in specifically in healthcare, it's an interesting industry because it's probably the least mature one, right? And attackers know this. And obviously, when it comes to monetizing the value, right, of an attack, it's harder to break in most of financial organizations because they are the most mature in comparison with other industries, and the nature of the healthcare business in itself, right, it's completely different. It makes it very difficult to regulate things. I've been working with healthcare organizations for many years. The last 2 years here in the U.S., I've had the opportunity to work with very large healthcare organizations, and I still do. And the main thing is the availability, right? Doctors, they need to have access to the information, and you cannot tell them, hey, you cannot access this record or you can't do this because of security reasons. They have a lot of power, right, in what can be implemented and what cannot, and it's kind of tough to implement regulations and to lock down these environments. So attackers definitely have been realizing of this in the last few years, and we've seen like waves of attacks, especially last year. Beginning of 2016, like we in the Foundation practice, we did like dozens and dozens of incident response cases with healthcare organizations here in the U.S. where the attackers followed very specific TTP, right? And they leveraged the specific vulnerabilities in healthcare software that was facing the internet to push manually payloads, right? And demand a ransom on these organizations. So I think that it's a mix of things. The probably the most relevant one being that in terms of security maturity, healthcare is very, very, very immature.
Yeah, I saw one report, I think it was from PwC, that it was roughly $200 per patient record in a breach response, but only about maybe $8 per record to take steps to prevent a breach. So there's still that seeming challenge to get over the business side of it to make it a business decision as opposed to an IT decision.
Right. Yeah.
So one of the things that I did notice too, that that's becoming a trend over the past year, and one of the things I saw you were working on was threat hunting, and it seems to be the new hotness in information security. Can you describe a little bit about what threat hunting is and what it really is and what people are doing?
Yeah, so threat hunting is, in reality, it's not that different from what we've been doing for many years, right? I mean, when you do incident response, you're trying to find the presence of the adversary in a network. That's the same objective of doing threat hunting. The main difference is that it's whether you're doing it in a reactive way or in a proactive way. So the concept behind threat hunting is, well, you have a SOC, right? We have invested in staffing a SOC. We have all the tools. We have all the processes. We have the people that are trained. And they're escalating incidents and investigating those incidents and all of that, it's okay, but then we still have breaches, right? And what's going on? Are we allocating money poorly? We don't have enough staff, and we're never going to have all the resources that we need, right? This is a principle in everything, in economy and in IT security. And the idea here is, let's not wait for an incident to happen. Let's go, and since we know that any given time there's going to be at least one machine that's going to be compromised, one attack that has managed to evade all the protection mechanisms and compromise a single box. It could be a phishing attack, it could be a watering hole attack, whatever it is. There's one system that is infected with something, some malicious code running there, maybe doing some beaconing, reaching out the bad guys. Let's not wait for the antivirus or the proxy or anything else to catch this up. If we kind of know the taxonomy, right, of these attacks, and we kind of know the indicators of compromise we should be finding, let's go and proactively hunt for those. Let's start to proactively find these indicators of compromise or indicators of attack in the network. So that's a concept. Of course, as everything else, right, there's a lot of hype and a lot of we like to do these things in this industry, right? We just want to rename things just because it sounds cooler, without actually putting a lot of thought into how different this is, right? Or how do we do this properly? And we see the same thing in products and services. With products, right, we've gone through this phases of just slapping NG in front of everything, next generation, and that makes everything cooler without actually changing the technology that much in some cases. And with services, kind of the same thing. Everyone is doing red teaming and threat hunting right now because it sounds cool. That's what you have to do. But then we still observe that many organizations that are still missing the basics and security 101 processes, right? Like asset classification. Like, for instance, you're never going to have a mature, proper threat hunting program if you don't have things like good asset classification or inventory, right? And knowing what your assets are and where they are and who are responsible for those. I know that sounds boring, right? It's not as cool.
Right. It's not as sexy to sit there and, well, we have to do a whole asset inventory and track software that's on that. It's not as fun sounding. So what does it take to develop a threat hunting program? Is there a threshold of a level of maturity that an organization should have? And what are some of the key elements before they kind of go down that path?
So that's a good question. Many people ask us, like, do we have to hire specific people just to do this? And of course, the more mature organizations have a mature SOC, they have a computer incident response team, and they have these processes, the playbooks, and probably the three levels of SOC level 1, 2, 3, and all of that in place, they might be able to have the resources to hire people and allocate them specifically to just to do the threat hunting. But you don't have to start with that. What I would say is, you know, set aside some time to do threat hunting on a weekly basis. And something I always say is that don't do threat hunting on a Friday afternoon if you don't want to spend the weekend in instant response mode, right? Because every time you're going to hunt for something, you're going to find stuff. And even if you don't find malicious activity per se, you're going to learn a lot about your environment, right? You're going to find policy violations and many other things. But a great way for starting would be just getting usually the people that is more skilled in your SOC or your incident response team and getting different people, right? Because hunting, you're going to need someone that knows the network. You're going to need someone that knows how to hunt in Windows, right? How to sift through Windows logs. If you have Unix servers, same thing. So you probably want to have people with different skill sets and set aside some time during the week saying, we're going to dedicate this time just to do hunting, right? And of course, make sure there's a goal. So what I recommend is use the MITRE ATT&CK as a framework, for instance. And we're all familiar with these, right? Kill chain or the MITRE ATT&CK chain. And the idea is look for something specific, like we're going to look for evidence of command and control. Okay, so if we have command and control traffic going on, what should we be able to see? Well, you should be able to see maybe command and control over port 80 or 443, some beacon activity. This activity might be going on at regular intervals. How do you hunt for this? Well, do we have the proxy logs? That could be a way to start with that, right? Can we look for persistent connections in our firewall logs or repeated connections in these logs? If we're looking for evidence of persistence, where should we see this? Well, auto run locations could be just one of the techniques that attackers might use. Can we maybe run a script and collect all these different entries in the registry for a number of systems? And then sort this out from the most common entries to the least common ones and look at the ones that choose the threes. And for sure, I guarantee you're going to find things that shouldn't be there, right? And in most cases, malware. So it doesn't have to be something very complex. As everything, I recommend start small. Try to get to know your environment, right? What works, what doesn't. And then from there, you can mature the process and maybe eventually have like a full dedicated threat hunting team. But it's always easier to justify these, even to management, right? When I teach these things, I always say, don't try to boil the ocean, right? And don't try to think too big, especially if you're going to need a budget to implement all of these things. And you go up front to management and say, hey, we need all this money. We need all of this hiring for this to happen. Start small and start showing value to the organization. If you start doing this on a weekly basis, even if on a monthly basis, if you cannot afford to do it on a weekly one, but put together a report and make sure that whatever you report, that drives improvement, right? There are lessons learned, and that feeds into a process where you're going to fix things, right? You're going to find root cause, and you're going to do something about it.
Gotcha. And one of the things I noticed too is that you developed a tool to kind of aid and assist with this called, and forgive me if I pronounce it wrong, but Rastreador?
Yes.
Which is Hunter. Hey, I got my Spanish today. Good. I sound like I know what I'm
talking about. Awesome. Yeah, when I chose the name, which is probably very unfortunate, I didn't realize how difficult it was to pronounce in English, but yeah. It's the Spanish version of Hunter, right? With a three, you know, replacing an E. Right, in English, the two speak, would be like a D, the D sound in Spanish. I know it's very confusing. But.
So tell us a little bit about that tool and what kind of caused, what was the impetus to design a tool like that and what it does?
So as everything, it comes out of the need for having to do something that you cannot do with the tools that you have at hand. So I was working out of this particular environment, and this was a large healthcare organization, like 50,000 nodes, with lots of tools, with management consoles and all the wheels, all the whistles and bells. But I had to manually just log onto machines remotely whenever I saw, like, let's say we were talking about command and control. If I would see a machine beaconing out to a domain that I deem suspicious, it was like, why is that? Like, what's the process that is kicking this this connection off, starting this connection? And I would have to go manually on the command prompt and look at, you know, a list of services, list of processes, what's in the auto run entry, and running, you know, various tools against this machine to get the output. And of course, there are some, there's been projects out there for a long time that would automate all of this, but they didn't have the flexibility that I needed, right, to add additional tools, to run additional commands. And since most of these endpoints were running a particular management agent, in this case was the McAfee agent, right, and managed by EPO, I thought there must be a way in which I could orchestrate this collection of data so I can just kick this process off this EPO console, right? And just say, hey, run all of these tools, all of these commands against this endpoint or this set of endpoints and send me the output to this directory. And then I can sift through all the results and all those text-based files. And it, something in addition to that I wanted to do was to use this for threat hunting, right? So many occasions you get these PDFs from vendors or from FBI saying, hey, we've known about this particular campaign and these are the hashes, the IP addresses, the domains you have to look for. Now, how do you hunt for that, right? So I thought I need some time to put this together. And I'm not a developer, but I've been developing for many years. In most cases, you know, like little projects. And I don't know how to get at least things done. The code might not be beautiful, but at least I can get some stuff done. So I actually took the opportunity, I think it was 2015, beginning of 2015, there was this big snowstorm here in New York, and I couldn't go to the office for 2-3 days. And, you know, that's how I define work, the absence of going to the office or having meetings. So I could actually sat down and spend 2-3 days just working on this code. And I use Python, and it's pretty, you know, kind of easy to do this these days. There are lots of libraries out there you can leverage and use the Yara bindings and a bunch of other libraries to put together this. And I tested it out in a couple of environments, and surprisingly, people said, hey, this works, and it's awesome. And it is not. It's just a simple little project, but I put it out there in GitHub. I believe that if you build something based on the knowledge you've acquired from the community, you have to share back with the community, right? And especially if it's, again, this is not rocket science. So I share out there, and I still get emails from, I got an email from a company in Australia a couple of weeks ago saying, hey, Shmuel, we're using this and it's awesome. We have customized a little bit the code, and now we can also run PowerShell commands on the endpoints, and it's yielding the results back that we need. We found evidence of persistence that we were missing in the very first day we ran in. I had another same comment from another government agency is running this in the U.S. Earlier this week, and I have lots of, you know, plans of improving it and doing some other stuff, having some kind of analytics maybe on the back end. But I also, you know, put it out there for people to take the code and just make whatever they want with it.
Yeah, I'll be sure to include links to the GitHub repository in the show notes. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, you've done many data breach responses, and as a responder, you know, you've probably seen some trends over time. And what's some of the trends that you've seen across a lot of these breaches that kind of gives you some pause where you might say to yourself, man, if they only had this one thing in place, this could have really stopped the attackers, or at least slowed the attackers down enough so the attackers change strategy to either try harder, which could be noisier, or just give up. So what's one thing that you see that's a common problem in a lot of organizations that they might not have in place that could really improve their security?
So it's hard just to say one, right?
Sure.
We typically see a few.
Yeah.
But if I have to highlight, let's say, a couple of those, one of the main things is that people deploy security software, right? Security solutions in what I call deploy and block and forget mode, right? It's like, okay, I bought this shiny device that's supposed to be awesome. It's going to stop the attackers. So I just put this on. Right, it's going to log, and it's going to log everything. It's going to send everything to the SIEM. So, of course, since we spend so much money on the SIEM, right, the SIEM is a magical device that will just make sense of everything automatically. And the things that I do not understand, the SIEM will understand it. Right, that's what's the biggest mistakes. If you do not understand the logs you're sending to the SIEM in the first place, that's bad, right? And what we see is just overclocked. Seems overloaded seams with lots of logs that are pretty much useless because you're not doing anything with that, right, with that data. That's one of the key things that we see across the board. People implement these solutions and they do not really understand what they can do with them. And they're implementing default mode. Many of the features are not enabled and not properly configured. There's been many cases that we have reacted to this year where if just, you know, customers had like some kind of HIPS features, right, or technology on the endpoints would have helped a lot in preventing outbreaks, right, large outbreaks from some of the worms we've seen earlier this year. And and some other, you know, bots and stuff like that. So that's one of the things that we see across the board. And the second one that is related to it, it's network segmentation, which to me it's basic hygiene, right? It's security 101. But unfortunately, many organizations, they're still driven by buying products without understanding that you need a sound architecture. You need to understand, again, where your crown jewels are. What are you trying to protect? Sometimes you ask customers, "Where are you trying to protect? Where is your most valuable data?" If an attacker would get into the organization, what they would go after, and where is that located? And sometimes they cannot answer that question. Right? So we're trying to protect everything. Well, you cannot protect everything, and you have to have a strategy around that. And once you identify what you're trying to protect, then you know. Put that in a proper segment that's monitored, that it's segmented off the rest of the network, so you can add additional controls. But what we see, it's none of that. It's typically once the attacker gets a foot on the network, they can move laterally, and then there's no visibility. It's like you put blinders on all these detection systems and you can't see anything because everything is so perimeter focused still today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that you do outside of your day job is teach quite a bit. How did you get into teaching with SANS and kind of being the instructor as opposed to just being a student?
So SANS story starts in 2006 or 2007. One of my best friends in Spain, he was actually the first SANS instructor in Europe, Jess Garcia. And we had to do some work together. And then he introduced me to SANS. I was like, hey, you know, we do these classes and we do this. And at the time, SANS wasn't really well known in Europe. I think there was just one event a year or something like that. It was in Brussels. And I remember like the first class I took was with him actually in 2006 or 2007. And it was the 508, the forensics class. And I thought that was the best train ever, right? And as I mentioned before, I've been always involved with training because it's something that I'm passionate about. And I found it was a great way of getting people to do the right thing, right? without forcing them or without auditing them, but just, you know, showing them how things work and encouraging them to take, to make the best decision by themselves. So I already developed my own classes, 2-day workshops and things like that. And I got addicted to taking such classes and taking the certs. So I think the second class I took was in London, 2007. That was with Johannes Ulrich, 543, Intuition Detection in Depth. And that was like mind boggling. I thought I was, wow, best thing ever. And I started to apply many of these things, many of these techniques. I started to deploy squeal sensors all over the world with iSoft, this company I was working for. And I really learned a lot. And eventually I did a training, I remember as well, in Kenya a couple of times. And someone in SANS, you know, in Europe, they contacted me and said, "Hey, Ismail, we know that you've already taught classes for years, and you've been part of the SANS community for some time. And we need someone to teach these classes in the community format in Europe." And that's how I started. So my first class, I thought it was in Berlin. I think it was 2010, and it was 543.
Gotcha.
Intuition Detection in Depth. And since then, I've been teaching forensics classes all over Europe. Went back to Kenya, actually, to teach 408 a couple of times. That was fun. And then since I moved to the U.S., I've been teaching, especially 511. It's a class I teach the most right now, continuous security monitoring, which is a lot about hunting, right? And many of the techniques that I described before. It's a great, great class.
Excellent. Well, Ismail, I really thank you for taking the time today. So where are some of the things online or places online that people can find you today? And what are some of the other things that you're up to that you may want to get out there?
As I said before, I don't have as much time as I wanted to update my blog, but I promise, because I've published a lot of stuff in the last year and I've done lots of talks. And so I'm going to spend some time in the next few days to go to my website and at least update the links, right? And make, put references to everything I've done lately. So it's not scattered all over the place, but that's my blog, blog.ismailvalenzuela.com. And I try to be active on Twitter as well. My handle is at @aboutsecurity. And of course, you can find me on LinkedIn. And I try to talk to people. And there's always, you know, people asking questions. And I try to set time aside to answer those as much as I can. Because I believe it's important to be active in the community. And as I said, I've benefited myself so much from the folks, you know, from SANS that I've learned a lot from, lots of blogs that I've read out there, books and so many resources from the community that I think it's important to give something back.
Definitely. I agree. Part of the reason I do the podcast, I think it's connecting people with others within the community. One of the things I did notice, I've had the pleasure of seeing you speak at a couple different conferences. What are you doing any conferences this year where you'll be presenting?
I think the next one will I'll be in Toronto, I think next week, but I will be at the SANS SOC Summit in DC in, I think it's going to be April or May. The SANS SOC Summit, definitely. We've been doing that for, I think this will be the third year. And it's a great event. I had the pleasure of co-chairing that event last year as well. And I think I've been talking at all of them too. And sometimes for, you know, people living here in New York, we do some events like twice a year as well. We do like half day events. Last one was the financial services briefing that we did in the city. It was November, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And we do regularly these events, and something that I usually do is whenever I'm attending one of these events, usually LinkedIn or Twitter, I add this information. So,
great. I'll be sure to put your Twitter handle and links to where you are online within the show notes. But I greatly appreciate you taking the time today. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for, you know, making this for everyone, making it available to the community again and sharing back. It's a great initiative, and it's been a pleasure and honor to be part of your project.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Cybersecurity Interviews. I hope that you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Please go to cybersecurityinterviews.com, where you can find every episode, including show notes and links for each guest. There you can also find social media links and to sign up for new episode notifications. Thanks. We'll talk soon.